History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some untold stories that we think ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Stockton, California, with a guy you really don't want to mess with. And he's got the shooting targets from the shooting range to prove it. We'll save the score that he posted at the range for you for a little later. But he's got a lot of experience in law enforcement and in the military. One of three brothers to serve in World War II. And a former deputy police chief here in Stockton, Les Novaresi, my guest today. So, Les, where do you fit in with those other two brothers of yours?
I'm the last of the brothers. I'm the youngest.
You're the baby.
I'm the baby. That's it. I'm the baby brother.
Well, and if people hear your last name, Novaresi, they assume, well, he must be Italian. But your heritage is a little different. Where did your parents immigrate from?
Switzerland. And I'm part German, part Italian. So I've got a little everything in me.
Did they ever tell you any stories about their homeland or why they came here to America?
Oh, they came here for the land of milk and honey. They thought the pot of gold was here, and they ended up in a dairy ranch.
Yeah, when you said milk, that wasn't figurative. That was literal.
Literally, right.
So did you grow up milking cows?
No, I milked a few, but we left the dairy ranches when I was about 7 or 8, and we moved to Stockton, California, where I went to school.
Yeah, so you're here in Stockton in 2019, but you were here in the 1930s. How much has changed since then? How is this community different?
Well, when I came here, it was only about 35,000. Now it's about 350,000. There's quite a change in it. You could leave the doors open at night. There's a lot of crime here now, so it's completely different.
And what kinds of things were you up to as a kid? What were the things that kept you occupied or kept your mind occupied?
Nothing, just playing like kids, playing baseball, basketball, football, generally just what kids do, and then going out to the ranches, the Swiss ranches, and helping milk cows and working the ranches. But other than that, the boy things, that's what we did.
Did you get along pretty well with your brothers?
Oh, yeah, I loved them. They were great brothers.
Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember at that age having these thoughts in your head of, hey, when I grow up, here are the things that I'm going to do?
No, I was just trying to make it through life. At that time, I didn't really have any idea what was I going to do. Then the war came along, and bingo, I was drafted. That was not the very nice time of my life, but I got through it, came home, went in the police department, and that was the rest of my life, and then I retired from then.
But you haven't retired from your practice with your firearms. How often do you go out and shoot to keep your eyes and your aim right?
Well, we go out twice a week. We got Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then it takes about an hour and a half to shoot. And then we go with all the old-timers and go to breakfast and shoot the breeze and lie to each other about how good we were.
Well, I know there's some truth with your story, too, about how good you were and how good you are. We'll get to that. But you mentioned the war came along. What do you remember about that? What was December 7th, 1941 like for you here in Stockton? How'd you find out?
Well, I think it was on the radio, but it was kind of traumatic. I remember that. But I was so young, I don't really, it's not that clear how it affected me. It was just, I remember the Pearl Harbor came about, and then my brother had already been in the service. He went in when he was 17, but I don't really remember a hell of a lot about it.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned your older brother, Sid. So now he's at war. Was that a concern to you? Did that rock your world a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I was worried about it because he was in the service, and I was worried about what was going to happen. And we were expecting the Japanese to attack the coast. In fact, he was guarding the coast at that time. No, we just, it was a terrible time. I remember that. Everybody was scared to death about the Japanese attacking. So, you know, that's the way it went.
Well, and I'm curious too, since you are here in California, San Joaquin Valley, where agriculture is the thing that drives the economy. And back then, there was a fair amount of the agriculture being carried out by Japanese Americans. Did you go to school with some Japanese American students?
Yes. Yeah, no, I went to Catholic school. There weren't any Japanese in my class. And then by the time I got to high school, they were all in the camps by then. But they had a lot of businesses here that they lost and homes that they lost. So, but I think now that people are really concerned about it now, about how we took their rights away and everything. But at that time, it was really a different story. You know, it was really pretty traumatic that we thought they were going to be spies and all that other stuff.
So that's what the buzz was. That's what the community felt was, this is a real concern.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, we were, everybody at that time, you know, the Japanese were our enemy. And so we certainly weren't going to, you know, treat them fairly, I don't think.
Well, if we were to drive over right now to the fairgrounds here in Stockton, right by the main gate, we would find a California historical marker that reads, "Here within the confines of the San Joaquin County Fairgrounds, enclosed by barbed wire and housed in temporary barracks, 4,217 San Joaquin County residents of Japanese ancestry, predominantly American citizens, were interned from May 10th to October 17th, 1942, under Executive Order 9066. It continues, "May such usurpation of civil, social, and economic rights without specific charges or trial never again occur." Again, that's the historical marker you can read if you're ever at the fairgrounds in Stockton, California. There were 125 barracks covering the infield area of the racetrack and another 40 barracks just east of the fairgrounds. The people held there temporarily were eventually moved to internment camps in Arkansas and Arizona. All told, of course, close to 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry were forced from their West Coast homes and moved inland, where they were held captive, as we've heard about quite a bit over the years on this program. So this is what's happening around you, Les, while you're in high school. And let's jump back into how you experienced those years. So your brother's in the service, and now he's at war, and you know now what kind of long career he had that we can talk about. But what about you and Elmo, your other brother? Were you guys thinking you were going to end up at this at some point too?
Oh, yeah, we knew the draft was coming, and I tried to get in the Air Force at the time, but that didn't work out. So here come the draft, and Elmo left first, and then I left about a year and a half later. Elmo went to Europe, and I went to the Pacific.
And when you say you wanted to fly, is that because there was an Army Air Corps base here in Stockton, and you saw those planes all the time?
Right. It was out at the airport, Stockton Airport. Yeah, they were training bomber pilots here at the time,
In fact, Stockton Army Airfield was the first advanced flying school on the West Coast. They started training pilots there almost a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Once it hit full speed, the base was graduating a class of 200 cadets about every 8 weeks or so. Of the 36 pilots who participated in what some would regard as World War II's most daring and improbable mission, the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo in April 1942, 11 of those 36 were graduates of Advanced Pilot Training School at Stockton Field. So this was an important spot on the map, and Stockton, California has some impressive history when it comes to American air power in World War II.
So you'd be out at school and see those things flying over?
Yeah, right. And my brother was, at that time, he was interested in aviation, and he finally went in the Air Force. He was in the artillery at the time when he first went in, and then he applied for the cadets, and he ended up as a cadet in Alabama. And when he graduated, I think in 43, he became a second lieutenant.
Yeah, and he went and flew overseas and then stayed in the service and ended up a major general. But for you, so one brother's gone, another brother's gone, and the draft comes for you.
Yeah.
What was it like saying goodbye to your mother and father now, who've seen three boys go off to war?
It was terrible. I remember when I left, I was real terrible. I was walking up the street to leave for the Fort Ord. My God, it was terrible. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was the baby of the family. I really was a terrible time for me. But when I got to camp, of course, you assimilate into the other fellas there. But it wasn't a good time for me.
Well, what was it like assimilating? What were the things you had to get used to with Army life as a teenager?
Getting along with different people and having chow with all these people and then sleeping in the barracks and marching and drilling and shooting. And it was a whole new world. I had never left home before, like many people. So it was a whole new world for me. But I made it. I assimilated. Finally, you make buddies. You finally get along with everybody.
Well, and I guess I should clarify. I mean, you got drafted. You hadn't finished high school yet. You actually had to leave high school?
That's right. Yes, I did. I was a junior, I think, yeah. My brother was a senior. But he, when he left, a teacher would send him classwork, and he graduated while he was in the service, and then my mother went and picked his graduation certificate up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I didn't do that. I had to come back and finish.
Well, and you had to get back. You had to get through the war and get back to finish. What are some of the things you remember about the training you went through or the way they whipped you into shape?
Well, they were very severe. You know, they called you all kind of names, and you had to march and run out of the barracks and drill and shoot. And it was just very traumatic for a young guy. You know, I was 18 years old. You finally get used to it, and it's a way of life. But I never really got accustomed to really enjoying the military. Mm-hmm. Never.
And what kind of unit did they end up putting you in?
I ended up in an infantry unit, a rifle company, mm-hmm. in the 7th Division, I Company. I ended up on training in Fort Ord and Fort Lewis and Hawaii. And then I got on a boat, and they shipped me out, and I ended up in Okinawa. That was it.
Well, and as people know, Okinawa is the tail end of the war, but I imagine as you joined these guys as a replacement in this rifle company, were there some guys who'd been there and done that, who'd been through a lot of this?
Yeah, there was a lot of old-timers. I was just a fledgling, and it was another bad experience. You know, your war is I don't even remember a hell of a lot about it, really. You kind of block that stuff out. But I do remember some of the good things, you know. Right after the campaign, my brother was stationed at Aoshima, which is an island off of Okinawa.
And I know our listeners are going to want to hear this story about your older brother, Sid, and how you two connected there half a world away from your hometown of Stockton, California. But we need to catch our first break. Les Novaresi is our guest today. Check out the photos and videos of Les online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Les Novaresi, 93 years old and a nearly lifelong resident of Stockton, California, the youngest of three brothers born to immigrants from Switzerland. All three of them would go on to serve in our armed forces during World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to a thorough and outstanding article about the three Novaresi boys that was published in the Stockton Record a number of years ago. Les and his brother Elmo were both drafted out of Stockton's Edison High School. Elmo became a combat engineer, while Les ended up in the 7th Infantry Division and fought in the Battle of Okinawa. When we left off, he was telling us about an incident that happened right after the fighting ended there. Les and Elmo's older brother, Sid, had joined the National Guard after graduating Stockton High School in 1939 and was called to active duty after the attack on Pearl Harbor 2 years later. Sid Novaresi became a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot, flying 125 missions with the 413th Fighter Group. While Les and Elmo both served in World War II and the Korean War,
The oldest Novaresi brother, Sid, would add Vietnam to his list of flying duties and would make the military a career, rising to the rank of Major General in 1977. Back in 1945, Sid was flying his P-47 on combat missions off of Aishima, an island that would become well known as the spot where journalist Ernie Pyle was killed on April 18th of that year. It wasn't too long after that Sid found out somehow that his baby brother, 18-year-old Les, was on nearby Okinawa, and the brotherly reunion that followed came as quite a surprise to Les.
And he flew over my camp, and I don't really know how he found out I was there. They flew over in a formation of three and flew over and then went right up over top of us. And then he landed and talked to my company commander, got me to go over and visit him at Aishima. So I went down to Naha at the field and flew over in a C-47 and visited him, and they dressed me up as a first lieutenant and so I could mingle with the guys. And they had chow with them, and they showed me films of their deeds when they flew into Tokyo shooting their rockets and stuff and shooting at boats and things, and that was exciting. So then I went back to my unit, and then from there, of course, we're training to attack Japan. It was going to be 99% casualties. And then they dropped the bomb, thank God. And I remember one of my sergeants said, he says, you know, it's going to be tough. You're going to go in and it's going to be 99% casualties, and they're going to come out with these spears and everything. He said, unfortunately, I won't be with you. Of course, he was joking. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, the war stopped, and we left Okinawa, and we went to Korea, occupied Korea, and I was about the 26th man ashore there. We circled in these Higgins boats until they give us the lights from the shore to go in, and we landed, and it was the tide went in, went 36 feet, I think, and so we had to wait till the tide went in, and then we landed, and then we went in and went into the airfield, and camped out there at the airfield, and then we started going north and taking the Japanese, taking them in custody, and shipping them back out to the coast to send back to Japan. That's about it, you know. Just, then we occupied it, and I left there in 6 months and came back to the States.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. First of all, you're telling this story about Okinawa, and your brother flies over, and you're trying to figure out how he even knows you're there. But you said something. I want to make sure people understand it. So in order for you to actually mingle with your brother and his fellow pilots, they had to put you in disguise, because you're an enlisted man in the Army. You're what, a PFC? So you're a PFC, and they have to give you a lieutenant's uniform. Otherwise, you can't even be around your brother. Were you nervous that you'd be found out?
No, I was having a hell of a time. They were all drinking, and I didn't drink at the time. And they had a few nurses to come by and mingle with them. And they went out and showed me their airplanes, and he showed me his airplane, which I, in private, in the civilian life, I trained as a aircraft mechanic. So that was interesting to me. But I had a ball with him. He was a hell of a brother.
Well, and you mentioned you guys actually had the opportunity to watch the film that had been taken from the cameras on the planes. Right. What was that like to watch that? Because that's not a movie. That's real life.
No, there's no sound to it. You watch him. One of the films, he was going in and shooting at a boat, and you could see the bullets going in, and then there was bullets come back out. I said, what? He said, they're shooting back at me. So, and then there was another film that when he went into Tokyo, he was shooting rockets into a building. You could see the rockets going in. It was really, really something. Unfortunately, he lost all of his camera films. He set his kit bag down somewhere, and then he lost it. He misplaced it. I would have loved to have those as a souvenir. Yeah.
Well, and something else. And I know some things can be hard to talk about, and I don't want to pry or ask you to talk about anything you're not willing to. But, I mean, you made it sound like you got to Okinawa and you were just a tourist. But I saw on your wall underneath your badge from your quarter century with the Stockton Police Department and another dozen years with the Sheriff's Department, And with all those mementos, there's also a combat infantry badge. So I know that you saw some action
with that I Company of the 17th Regiment and the 7th Infantry Division. What was that like, and what do you remember?
I don't remember a hell of a lot. It's just a lot of ducking and trying to keep alive, that's all. Yeah. I don't remember a hell of a lot about it, really. You kind of block that out, to tell you the truth. I don't really have that much memory of it, tell you the truth.
But there was still fighting going on when you got there.
Oh, yeah, sure, certainly there was, yeah. But I survived, that's it. Yeah. I survived.
Well, and that's what I want to understand, and I want people listening to understand, because we talk about, well, the price of freedom. And the price of freedom is people like you risking your lives over there. So, I mean, I can imagine what some of the hazards might have been, but you would know for sure. You're with this rifle company, so where are you sleeping at night?
In a foxhole. What do you think? Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that was very comfortable and no problems.
Yeah, and it rained a lot, so... A lot. It was bad memories. So I kind of blocked that stuff out.
And I'm guessing you'd never been through anything like that before, right?
Never. I was a mama's boy. Uh-huh. I don't. Mama took good care of me.
Uh-huh. And now there's no mama, and one of your brothers is flying his plane. The other one's in Europe, and you're there all alone. Did you have some buddies that you got to know that you knew you could count on?
Yeah, I had one, a special friend, Russ Lamberskin. He was from Marysville, and he ended up being my platoon sergeant. But he got wounded, and he shot him in the shoulder, not a deep wound. He went back, and he came back right away. But he was a great big guy, about 6'4". He was a hell of a soldier. Anyway, we made real good friendship. In fact, when I got out of service, I visited him in Marysville for a couple of weeks. And then he eventually moved to Stockton. And he stayed here until he worked for the government and went overseas with him again. But he was a very dear friend of mine. But he also is dead. He's passed.
Sure.
Everybody's passed. I'm the last of the Mohegans. All of my company, they're all passed away. I'm the last of the Mohegans. In fact, I'm the oldest living Stockton police officer.
So this teenager in Okinawa, sleeping in foxholes, you've got your buddy that you just told me about. Did you have to deal with enemy artillery? Was there a threat of that coming in and landing on you? Oh,
yeah, certainly. But like I say, that's almost left my memory. Huh. Yeah, that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, they had artillery, but not that much toward the end, because we were winning the war. But the nights were the worst, of course, you know, because you don't see what's happening. But bad memories. I just don't dwell on them anymore.
Well, and maybe that's part of why you've had the career you've had and you stay so active and say so young at your age. Maybe it's because you haven't dwelled on those things. But when you say the nights are the worst, is that because you could hear things happening and you can't see them, or you just imagine what might happen?
Imagine a lot. You can't see anything and you imagine a lot, you know. Your memory, your imagination runs amok. It's a bad time of the night. The nights are the worst. But we all survived, you know. We left our company, went in with 220 men, and left with 127.
Were any of those guys who were killed there people that you knew or had gotten close to?
I knew some of them, yeah. But you like to say that's so long. You know how long ago that was?
Yeah.
Many moons. many moons.
Yeah, almost 75 years.
Yeah.
And again, I'm sorry if I'm being too persistent here. You put the hand up, tell me to shut up if I need to. But when somebody from your company gets wounded, gets killed, how do you handle that mentally? Does your mind go to, hey, I'm probably next, or hey, it's not going to happen to me?
It's self-preservation. It's all self-preservation. You know, you look out for your buddies, and it's you just go on. It's just like the police department. If you have one of your buddies killed, you got to. Go on. I don't remember it being a big deal, mm-hmm. really.
Well, and I guess there's that perspective. A lot of the veterans I talked to, they were in the service 75 years ago, and they didn't have a law enforcement career like you. So really, I mean, you've lived a good chunk of your life knowing that you could be in harm's way.
Yeah, but any veteran that's seen anything at all, they don't talk about that stuff. They don't go to the movies where they shoot 'em ups. They don't. The ones I know, you don't hear them talking that stuff. They're more internal. They're more internal. They really are. Yeah.
With that in mind, I ask this respectfully: is there a moment that you look back on, that you feel like that was a really close call, that could have been it for you, like so many of those other guys you knew?
No, not really. Not really. One day was just like the next. Yeah. They were all just like the next. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, I forgot about that stuff. I really did. Mm-hmm. I really did. I haven't dwelled on it you bring it up now. Sure. I haven't even thought about it, uh-huh. really.
But as far as what you guys did there, you had an objective, an area that you were supposed to take over, and how would you advance?
Very gingerly. Very gingerly. No, it's like I say, I don't even remember that. I don't even remember that much about it.
And as you said, you were training to invade Japan, and they told you how steep the odds were going to be. So it must have felt pretty good when you heard Japan was surrendering.
Yes, it did. It felt fantastic. We kind of cheered a little bit, and then we just said, when are we going to go home? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know there'd be another 6 months before I could go home, because all the old-timers had points. You know, you had points, then you so many points that you could get to go home. And we had guys that had been there since Attu, Kiska, Kwajalein, Leyte, and Okinawa. They were all, they'd been there all that time. And in fact, my platoon sergeant, he looked like an old man. He had a beard, and when he shaved it off, he was 24 years old. Hey, 24 years old. I thought he was an old man.
Well, I have heard some stories about how quickly war can age you, and even guys, their hair turning white overnight. But you mentioned you guys were sent to Korea, and you were part of some interesting things there. You were part of the crew that actually orchestrated or carried out the changeover of control?
Yeah, we did. In fact, when we went in there, I was, my platoon and a platoon from the 184th and the other regiment took the Japanese flag down, and we were assigned, we were gathered around. Somebody took the flag down, but we were the honor guard that took the flag down, the Japanese flag down. That was my claim to fame. In fact, I had a video of it, and I don't even know if I can work the video anymore, but I had a video of it. Of me making a circle so that we took the Japanese flag down. And I don't know who, probably some admiral got it or some general got it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it.
But you had it in your hands.
No, I didn't. I didn't even get it in my hands. Somebody else had it in their hands. I just was the honor guard. And then it was all, then from then on, I was just guard duty. We went to Taejon, I think that's the town. And we set up a barracks there. And then until I mustered out, we just did patrol work there and just, you know, the usual military stuff, guarded the barracks. We guarded a repo depot there that had all kind of supplies. Mm. But then I came home.
Did you have any interaction with Japanese prisoners?
Yes. We got them and took the weapons away and sent them back in carts and trucks to the coast so they could be taken back to Japan. Yeah.
Was there anything memorable about that, or did they leave you with any particular impression of who they were?
No, I talked to one Japanese lieutenant who had been, he trained in America, and he could speak English. That was an interesting part, you know, he spoke pretty good English. But other than that, nothing. They were just soldiers like me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what about the Korean civilians there? Did you get a sense of what a big deal it was for you guys, for America, the Allies, to liberate them from Japanese occupation?
Yeah, we did. Well, we had a lot of contact with the civilians, and they were pretty approachable. And, of course, you couldn't speak the language, so that was kind of difficult. But, we'd go out and meet them and talk to them. But other than that, we were kind of closed, you know, with our own company. But we didn't ever get too chummy with them. We just were there kind of a occupation. That's it. Mm. Yeah, it wasn't very interesting.
This is kind of a crazy question, but I'm guessing you might have some perspective. If you can put yourself in the mind of that kid, that teenager who's there in Korea in 1945, and someone had told you, hey, America's going to be back here at war in Korea in 5 years. Would you have believed him?
No, I wouldn't have believed him. No, I wouldn't have believed him. And they wanted me to re-up. Thank God I didn't re-up. They would have made me a sergeant, platoon sergeant. And I said, No thanks. Because I would have been right in the thick of it again. Yeah, that would have been. I don't think I would have made it this time. So, no, I wouldn't have believed it. And then we lost a lot of good people there. Lots of them. Yeah, police action, they called it.
Well, and a lot of them are still over there, still unaccounted for all these years later. But you were in the service during the Korean War. Tell me what you were doing.
I joined the Air Force Reserve, and by God, the Korean War started. So here I go again. I ended up at Mather Field, and then I went back to Chinook Field for some training. And I crewed a B-25, the training. There were training missions with a B-25. And then I think I only served about 15 months there. And then I got out, and then I went to the police department.
And the Stockton Police Department has been part of his life ever since. In fact, even though he is the oldest living alumnus of that department, he still finds a way to give back. It has to do with a skill he keeps oh so sharp by practicing a couple times a week. And you can see a little photographic evidence of that online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll hear about it from 93-year-old Les Novaresi when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 93-year-old Les Novaresi of Stockton, California, where he once served as Deputy Chief of Police. He spent nearly 40 years in law enforcement after serving in both World War II and the Korean War. As we've heard, Les has tried to block out the memories of his time in combat during the Battle of Okinawa, when of the 220 men in his company, I Company of the 17th Regiment, 7th Infantry Division, of those 220, only 127 came through without being physically wounded. At his home in Stockton, Les displays his medals, which include the Combat Infantry Badge and even the Bronze Star. But displayed above those even more prominently are a picture of him in a different uniform and his badge from 25 years in the Stockton Police Department, which he joined after his Korean War service in the Air Force. What was it that possessed you to pursue that path, Les?
I mean, here you'd been at war, getting shot at, and you just told me that was so bad that you've purposely forgotten about it. What made you want to get into law enforcement?
I was looking for a job, probably. I was looking for a job, and I was always oriented for law enforcement. I was always a military-type guy, you know, because of my brothers. So I took the test. My dad said, why don't you take the test? And I did, and I passed it. But meanwhile, before I went in, I was recalled to the Air Force when I should have been a policeman. So I should have gone on the police department in 50 or 51. But I went back into service, so I was not cheated, but I should have had two more years in the PD than I had because I went back into service. But no, I liked being a police officer. It was good. It was a good, honorable job. Good, honorable job. And I really worked at it. I was a good street cop. When I made detective, I was I wasn't the greatest detective, but I was a great street cop. I really loved the street. So that's where the rubber hits the road, you know, in the street. So I was pretty good there.
Well, I'm sure there's some stories from those years, too. Yeah. That's not an easy job. That takes a toll on you, on families. What are some of the things that you remember? And when you look back, you say, boy, I was pretty fortunate to get out of that situation, or I'm thankful this went down the way it did.
There are so many. One particular incident, some guy had an axe up at the top of the stairs, and me and my partner were running up the stairs, and he raised the axe, and I ran up by the stairs and ran by him and grabbed the axe, went right by him. That's one small incident. There's a lot of those, you know, because most policemen have those. I had once, we had with my partner, we went to this monkey was loose in his house, and he crapped all over my partner. And there's always these funny ones, you know, they were having a family fight, and my partner went up to the door, and the guy broke the door down, and the door went over my partner, and the guy walked over the door. But, I mean, there's a lot of funny incidents in the police work, but it's a good job, and it's an honorable job, and I'm glad I was a police officer. I did a lot of good things, and I made a few mistakes, but in the overall scheme of things, I really enjoyed it.
Police officers, law enforcement in general, have been kind of a hot-button issue in our country the last few years. We hear opinions from a lot of different perspectives. Is there something you think is misunderstood, maybe, about police officers, law enforcement personnel, from your experience? Is there something that maybe people who haven't walked in your shoes or, you know, worn that hat or carried that baton don't understand?
Yeah, we go for the crime, not the person. In other words, we don't go for nationality or race. We go for the crime. If you do the crime, we go for you. And a lot of people, you know, when these stops that they make, we try to judge. And a good cop sees or kind of has a feeling for, you know, who's doing what. If he works a good the beat and he knows the people on the beat, he knows who's doing what. He keeps his eyes open and his mind open. He knows who's doing the crime. And so consequently, he makes those stops. And sometimes he might be a little aggressive, and that offends some people. And that's the part I feel they're misunderstood. The people want, they say, we need more police in our area. And the minute you put more police in the area, they said, you're picking on us. You're stopping us too much. So it's kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't. But it's an honorable, you know, I think that it's a misunderstood business. But without the police, you'd be in dire straits. You know that as well as I do. I really think that, the way the law is or the way the crime is going, you know, Stockton is really, the crime here isn't all that great. It seems to be getting a little better. You know, I could shut a town down without any problem, but you'd get a hue and cry from everybody because you'd be stopping people. They don't like to be stopped and checked out. But, you've got to get to a criminal's got to get from point A to point B. He has to walk there or drive there. And the only way you can do that is you got to stop people and talk to them. You got to do it in a medically prescribed manner, but that's the way you stop crime. You stop, talk to people. You do it in a nice way, but it's a never-ending problem. So that's my take on it.
Well, and one of the things that you did in your years with the Stockton Police Department, you competed in shooting competitions.
Yes, I did.
How did that come about? Where did that come from?
Well, I like shooting, and my partner was Henry Perez. He started me shooting, and I just took a liking to it. And we used to go up to Oakland and shoot the target. Then I just really took a liking to it. Then we formed the practical police course. Really became popular. You know, that's a silhouette target. We formed a team in the early 50s. And we became very proficient, and we start winning everything. And then I stayed with it. And after I retired, I didn't shoot for 28 years. And then I went back to it, and then I got my speed up to it, and I started shooting really good again.
And again, I apologize if I ask some dumb questions, but I'm just wondering, if you guys go and you compete, and I'm looking at a picture right here where it says, you know, California State PPC, that's Practical Police Course Champions, 1966. So you guys were the best in the state. Was there any value to that besides just the pride and satisfaction? Is that something that in the community, maybe the bad actors paid attention because they knew how sharp you guys were?
Oh, I don't know about that, but it made you proficient because the Practical Police Course is you started at 7 yards and you drew and fired quickly and you had to shoot in so many seconds. Mm-hmm. It kind of made your skill much, much, much better. Mm-hmm. So it was good for your work, you know. And I'm sure, I doubt if the bad guys even paid attention to that. You know, they're thugs a thug, you know, and they never paid any attention to that. You stop and tell them, hey, you know how good of a shot I am.
Well, I guess more practically speaking, though, it could save your life, right? If you're better at that and quicker.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I could stick it in your eye at 25 yards. You know, you'll see. If you give me five shots at you, I'm going to hit you in the head. So, and there's a lot of guys that, not a lot of guys, but there's enough of them that are really good shots. And, of course, some of them aren't that great, but they practice. They're out there at the range all the time, and they have class after class trying to teach these guys how to shoot the rifle and the shotgun and the pistol, of course. I think shooting, it's one of your tools. You don't carry a baseball bat or a bowling ball, you know, or a saber. You carry a pistol.
Well, and I guess I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you whether you ever had to put that training, that expertise to use in the field.
Yeah, I've shot it at people, but the only time I ever hurt anybody was with a club. I had an altercation with some culprit, but I've shot at a car, and I shot at a fleeing suspect, but I never shot to hit him. I shot to scare him, and which now is taboo. You don't do that anymore. When you draw your weapon, it's to shoot a fleeing or shoot a felon fear for your life or fear of somebody else's life. But they've changed the rules since I was a patrolman. In those days, you had a lot of things you did that you can't do now.
Well, and as far as your accuracy in firing, so state championships is part of that police force team, but you've continued, as I mentioned. And how old were you when you got the highest score that anybody's ever gotten around here?
I think it was about 85.
Yeah?
Yeah, 85 years old.
And people who don't know shooting, they don't know what it means. Maybe they think of bowling. If you bowl a 300 game, that's perfect. And in shooting, when you're working on these targets, it's the same story, right?
No, it's harder to shoot a 300 shooting than it is 300 bowling, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Much harder.
Posted on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook and also at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a video that explains this a little bit better.
When you're shooting these targets, the best possible score is 300.
300 is it.
That means you put every single bullet in the tightest bullseye.
That's right.
And you shot a what?
299.
So that means you missed one.
I missed one.
By how much?
By about a quarter of an inch.
And how many shots did you fire?
30.
So 29 were perfect bullseyes and one was barely off.
Yep.
Have you met anybody else who's done that?
Yeah, there was one other guy that did that.
How old was he?
32 or something.
And you were 85?
Yeah, 85 at the time.
And now you're 93, and you're still at it.
I had my eyes done, the restore. I did the restore in my eyes for my shooting, so I'm trying to keep up with it. But I'm getting old now, you know, it's starting to creep up on me. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make that 300.
You were saying you don't hear anything while you're shooting. Do you have to control your breathing, too?
Yeah, you do, yeah. You have to, and you breathe in. Hold it, then you shoot, and you breathe in, hold it, shoot. It's a technique. Everybody's got a different technique. I use the isosceles hold. Then there's a weaver with the outside thumb. But it's a lot of fun. A lot of people are against guns, but I'm not.
Well, and you probably have some good perspective. I'm sure there are people on both sides of that issue that don't really understand the issue the way you do. Why do you appreciate or value firearms the way you do?
Because they're there for a purpose. They're there to protect you. But nobody should own a gun that is not practicing shooting it. If a man can't shoot a gun in a reasonable fashion, he shouldn't have it. He should not have a gun. If he's not trained with a gun, the man shouldn't have one, including a rifle. I think every man should have a gun, or woman that wants one, except you've got to have a stellar character, of course. And you got to have the skill, because if you shoot and miss and you hit some poor bystander, that's not doing anybody any good. It's like in New York, they had this police officer, two police officers, by the Empire State Building. Somebody killed a psychiatrist up in the building and came down. Two police officers saw him and shot at him 9 times, both of them, and they missed him, hit him once, and it hit a bystander, broke a couple of windows. Those policemen weren't trained right, apparently. But in a huge department like New York, how the hell can they train those 45,000 policemen properly? Even us, we have a problem training police officers properly out there. and we're only 400.
How involved do you remain with Stockton PD? What's your connection to them now?
No, I help some train some of the guys I have, not so much lately, but when I see a young patrolman struggling, I go out and help him. So does my other two other buddies. They see somebody that needs help, we go out and help them to shoot. And I'm always available to help a young fella, and they appreciate it, because I don't want somebody come to my house that can't shoot straight. He's liable to shoot me. But I just said, we go out to the range and we're available to all of the young guys. Other than that, we don't do anything for the PD. We're just, like I said, we go out and we enjoy ourselves. And if we're of any can be of help, we help them.
Well, and you help them with shooting. But I'm wondering, in general, if there's somebody listening right now, maybe it's a young person and they're thinking about a career in law enforcement. I imagine you've had to do this a time or two. What's the best advice you can give to a young man or a young woman who's thinking about that as a career?
I think it's the best career in the world. It's an honorable position, and you can contribute to the well-being of your community, but you got to have the calling for it. You just can't put a uniform on and just put in your time. You got to have the zest for the department or for whatever department you want to go on. Otherwise, you shouldn't go on the police department. You just got to have the calling for it. You'd be doing your community a favor and probably yourself. And it's a good paying job now, too. I mean, it's not like the old days where they paid you peanuts. They pay you a good salary now.
Are there some things temperament-wise or psychologically that you think are essential to a good police officer?
Oh, yeah, you got to have a good mind where you're not hot-tempered. You got to be able to handle stress. You can't let the, because you're going to get a lot of insults. You're going to be working under bad conditions. No, you got to be very calm. That'd be the greatest asset you have. Because if you're the nervous type, you're not going to make it. They're going to get to you.
Insults? What are you talking about? You mean people called you names?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. They call you all kind of names. Everything but a man of God. Everything but a man of God.
What's the worst thing someone ever said or called you that you can actually say on the radio?
I can't. No, they get into your family, talk about your family. That's the worst. They say some awful things. Yeah, bad, bad, bad. Yeah, it's kind of tough sometimes. Kind of tough.
So you got to have a lot of self-control, too.
That's the one. Self-control. That's probably the biggest. That's the best one. Self-control. If you don't have that, you're not going to make it, because you'll end up smacking somebody or hurting him real bad, and then you're going to pay the price.
Self-control, a key attribute for anyone who wants to follow in the footsteps of Les Novaresi's selfless service. The Army in World War II, the Air Force during the Korean War, followed by 37 years in law enforcement, and now at 93, still on target. Don't forget to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a video demonstration of just how steady his shot remains. That's our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude.
Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.